From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about environmental issues and sustainable living. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
So in the first half of the show today, we'll be speaking with the co-founders of Park City's first commercial composting business, Park City Compost. That's Colin Beach and Travis Wright. They'll tell us how it's done and why.
And in the second half of the show, we're going to talk about the Rockport 5 fire. Not so much what the fire did, but what happens next with respect to the ecosystem that was burned during this four-day event. Joining us will be two professors from Utah State University who specialize in forestry and fire ecology, how ecosystems recover from fire, who comes back and who doesn't, and how long does it take. All that and a discussion on a proposed project to extract and cook oil out of shale in eastern Utah. I won't get into details yet now, but just picture rock cooking in the largest tandoori oven you can ever imagine for 90 straight days.
It's a good
mental
image.
That's just part of the process we'll be talking about and some of my thoughts about that. Of course, you can join in on today's discussion by posting your questions or comments to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth.
The environment and our connection to it. It's This Green Earth, and it all gets started right after a few words from our underwriters.
Hi, this is Gordon Raymond with Republic Services, your recycling and garbage services provider, and a proud supporter of KPCW. Recycling pickup in Summit County is now every other week. Remember, recycling materials go in your larger blue or brown bin. Gray is for garbage. AlliedWasteUtah.com/Summit County.
Park City Restore turns your donation of gently used home furnishings, construction materials, and furniture into affordable housing through Habitat for Humanity in Summit and Wasatch Counties. Check habitat-utah.org for a list of items accepted at the Restore during business hours, Wednesday through Saturday, 10 to 6. Restore is located in Silver Summit at 6280 Silver Creek Drive. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a nonprofit organization.
This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for?
TED Radio Hour, Sunday morning at 10. Brought to you by Albion Financial Group and Board Docs.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that's Chris Cherniak across the board. And in the studio with us this morning are Colin Beach and Travis Wright, and they are the co-founders of Park City and Summit County's first commercial composting business. So welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us on.
Good morning.
So let's start with the motivation for starting your business. How long have you guys been going, and what made you decide to take this on?
Well, originally we were tree service company out here in Summit County, and we were dumping our wood waste over at the landfill. This year they had changed a couple policies to where we weren't, as contractors, able to dump at the landfill anymore, and we didn't really like the way that they actually took the wood waste and just kind of buried it into topsoil and covering up all the landfill waste.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided we wanted to take our wood chips and do something good with it. So what we did is we started a compost company, Park City Compost LLC, located out off of Browns. And that's what we originally started doing with our wood chips this season.
And it started just with your wood chips. And that's it. And then we'll go see how it has expanded from there. But
Definitely. So...
do you have much of a background in composting, let's say, or, you know, just a rudimentary understanding of what it was about?
We are definitely on the tree care side of things.
Right. Tree guys.
I grew up with a compost pile in my backyard.
Okay.
So I have a lot of experience in the backyard composting. But as far as a commercial operation goes, we've been doing a ton of research. Right. We've hired on a consultant to help us out a little bit, get us going on the right track.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it is definitely a little bit of trial and error. And just seeing how the process works and how we need to adjust it accordingly.
Right. Okay.
And so, as Chris kind of mentioned, you guys have now expanded to do a lot more than just compost your own wood waste. So tell us about that.
So for the past month and a half now, we have been collecting organic food scraps from the three resorts here in town. At this point, we're only collecting fruits and vegetables, paper products, coffee grounds is a big one, stuff like that. No meats, no fats and oils, and no dairy are the big three that we can't accept. And so over the past month and a half, we have collected over 15 tons of food scraps from the three resorts. And all that has been diverted from the local landfill and sent to our facility where we mix it in with wood chips and start the composting process.
So was it hard to convince the resorts to jump on the bandwagon, or were they looking for somebody like you to take their compost?
They were looking for us, which made it pretty easy. But so far, you know, we've run into a few issues. We've had some contamination issues, which we're working with, changing some things on our end. But yeah, so far everything's gone very smoothly with the resorts, and they seem to be happy.
I'm curious about the contamination issues. I mean, it's not all like perfectly fresh greens and unused food scraps and stuff. You get lots of other plastics and paper.
Yeah, you get a lot of people just walking by a trash can. They just think, oh, trash can. We're going to take our plastic gloves off and throw it in a trash can. So we've been having to piece through it, and we've been able to give feedback and get feedback from everyone. And
right.
It's all coming together.
Okay.
Little things like the pineapples have a little plastic hanger tag on them. And they chop the head off the pineapple, throw it in the compost bin, and who would have thought of that little plastic tag that's on there?
Sure. So these are the things that you've got to actually kind of filter out.
That must be a fun job, the filtering process.
And, you know, that's something that the industry as a whole needs to address.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just a composter issue or a vendor issue. It's coming from the pineapple suppliers and the vegetable suppliers. They're introducing plastic into their materials.
Right. Right. Okay. And so you have to deal with that. All right. So you got wood chips and now you're getting food scraps and things like, I mean, what kind of area are you talking about? How much area does this require?
So currently we have leased a 1-acre site from a rock quarry out in Browns Canyon. We have the potential to expand probably 3 to 4 times the size that we're currently at. But our wood chip pile takes up probably half the space of our acre, and the compost pile is growing very quickly.
So how long does the process take from the time you get this material from the resorts to the time that it's like, you know, usable soil or compost?
So the piles that we are creating right now, we are hoping to have finished compost available for the community coming this spring. Our system, what we do is we mix the food scraps and the wood chips together, and then we place it on a blower system, which forces air underneath the piles. Mm-hmm. It's called an aerated static pile. And what that does is it keeps the oxygen levels in the pile at the right level for the decomposition process mm-hmm. to take place. And it also cuts back on the amount of diesel fuel that we have to burn by manually turning the piles.
Okay, because that's a different type of composting, a kind of a windrow process where you're actually turning the pile to aid in bacterial decomposition. But here, like you say, it's static, but you have to burn some energy to blow air through that pile.
Exactly.
Okay. But less.
Less than running a tractor, though.
Okay. So it gets
And it's, you know, it's a little bit more difficult for us in the forefront. We've got to make sure our pile's set up correctly. We have to have larger particle sizes in there, which is why kind of the wood chips really work well. And it keeps the airspace within the pile built up. Since we aren't coming in manually turning it, fluffing it back up, we've got to have that porous space from the get-go.
So there's a science to this thing. There's a lot of chemistry and biology that goes into this. It's not like people just buying a composting bin
right now and
being able to – when it goes to a large scale like this, there's a lot more issues that have to be considered operationally, construction-wise, et cetera. So what about – is there a formal design? Was there permits required to do this?
There are permits required. We were pretty fortunate that the landowner that we were leasing the land from had already gone through the permitting process when he set up his rock quarry operation. So he fought the battles for us.
Really?
And we were able to come in under his existing use permit.
So for the same permit that he's allowed to quarry rock, you can do a composting facility.
Very handy.
He had the foresight to cover
all
bases.
Because otherwise, that's what I was thinking. Otherwise, as an engineer, the permitting process can be kind of onerous.
So what about smell? Is there a bad smell? Is that an issue? You always hear on a residential level, like, you know, if you have a small compost pile in your backyard, it shouldn't smell. It shouldn't really attract wildlife. You know, you should be okay. Are you dealing with those issues?
We really haven't had any odor issues. If the pile is maintained correctly and we have our formula set up right, we've got the right moisture levels, we really shouldn't have an odor issue. And honestly, the past month is probably the toughest time to compost with the extreme heat and dry conditions. So we feel pretty lucky that we haven't had any major issues so far. And that was a big hurdle right there for us.
That's another point. How much water is required, given how dry this area is? I mean, there's water required, right? And how much?
We do have to add a little bit more water into the feedstocks as we mix them. Another benefit of using the food scraps is they're 70% water to begin with.
Right.
So that's a large percentage of our moisture. And then depending on what kind of wood chips we're mixing in, if there's a lot of green leaf material in there, we don't have to add as much water. But if it's just straight dry pine bark, then we've got to add some water.
You got to add some water. So again, you're constantly cultivating this. That's really what you're doing. You know, you're cultivating a biomass.
Every day we're going through our piles and figuring out what they need, what we need to add, what we need to subtract.
Okay.
Every day we're taking temperatures of our piles.
No kidding. Yeah.
Every day. It's a maintenance thing. Every morning, every evening.
That's really interesting. And so, but at the same time, you're introducing fresh scrap. You're setting up a new pile. You're managing an ongoing pile. And then you have eventually a finished pile, correct? What is the finished pile? I mean, how long did you say does it take?
So the active phase of composting, which is the phase that we're in right now, should last about a month and a half to 2 months. And we're considering the pile that we've built in the past month finished. We're moving on to starting our next pile. So about another month and a half, and we should move out of the active phase of composting into the curing phase, which is when stuff really starts to settle down. Right now in the active phase, we're going through and the piles are heating themselves up between a temperature of 130 and 160 degrees, which kills all the weed seeds in it and any sort of pathogens that are within the food. So once we get to a finished state of our compost, it should be weed-free and pathogen-free.
Wow.
It sounds like you know, cooking meat or something when you have to make sure it reaches a certain temperature to kill all the bad things.
For the right amount of time. You don't want to overcook it. Okay.
So how does the pickup work for this? Are you going to the resorts and picking this stuff up? You know, are they paying you to do this as a service? How does that work?
So we
– Nobody wants to take that question.
Wait till you hear the answer.
I'm the tree guy.
So we collect from the three resorts here in town. And what we've done is we've set up a process where we supply the resorts with compost bins, 50-gallon wheeled bins, similar to your recycling can or your trash bin at home. The kitchens themselves, they've all got different methods. Some have little 5-gallon pails right there at the workstations with the chefs, and then they'll dump it into the larger one. Some go directly into the larger bin right from the start. But so they've all got their own method of getting it into the bin, and then we come along twice a week and swap out the bins. So we grab the food scraps, bring them back to our facility, and leave them with a clean bin in its place. We actually put a little bit of wood chips in the bottom to grab whatever liquid is in the food scraps right there. It cuts down on the odor and the flies on site.
Okay. So I'm assuming this is a for-profit business. And by the way, if you're just joining us, we're talking to Colin Beach and Travis Wright, co-founders of Park City Compost, LLC, right here in town. And they're describing their how they set up a commercial composting business, which right now includes wood chips from a separate tree service and food scraps from, among other things, the three resorts here in town. So, like I said, you're a for-profit business, hopefully, right? Where does your revenue come from? Are you charging the resorts to take away their food waste, or are you going to be charging customers for the sale of this finished product?
So it's definitely a two-part strategy to that. We try to cover a lot of the costs up front with the collection fees, and then we also open up our facility to local landscapers in town where they can drop off their yard debris, and we'll chip it up and add it to our piles.
Okay.
So we generate both the collection fees and a tipping fee from the landscapers. And then the goal is once we have finished compost available, we'll sell that to the local community as well.
Okay. And you'll set it like in a per bag or some type of package?
More than likely bulk. To start. Okay. So pickup truckloads or directly to the landscapers where then they provide it to their clients at smaller rates.
That's fantastic. We'll have to keep an eye out for that
yeah.
in the spring. So are you planning to expand to residences? You know, if somebody wants to start composting at their condo or something, can they give you guys a call?
Certainly. So right now, our facility is equipped to handle essentially the volume that we have coming in, which is about 15 tons a month of food waste. And a little bit more. So our next goal is to identify some more commercial kitchens in the area and get them on board to help with the process. But certainly the ultimate goal is to expand into residential pickup. But if people would really like to be involved from the start, there's always backyard composting that they can do, or they could do drop-offs to our facilities. But just get in contact with us, and we can help you set that up.
This is an ongoing, everyday process. Does the winter present any challenges?
A little bit more with access to our site.
Okay.
The composting process itself shouldn't slow down at all in the winter. It's self-heating.
Okay.
We may have to do certain things to jumpstart it a little bit, like introduce already processed compost back into the starting piles just to jumpstart it a little bit. Or we can do some other things to mechanically heat it. But we're expecting that we should be.
But it's not so cold here that it's that the system becomes.
People are
too
doing
difficult.
This in the Northeast where it's bitter cold, all over.
Okay.
So our climate is actually kind of friendly for
it. So you'll be collecting food scrap, and maybe, you know what? I bet your food scrap will go up in the wintertime.
Certainly.
High season. So you're going to have no shortage of raw material.
Not at all. If anything, it's the wood chips that we need.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yep.
So people can bring you wood chips
definitely,
for a small fee?
Definitely.
Get it off their hands?
Okay. Definitely. If people have wood scraps from their yard, like trees that they cut out or something, they can come dump at our facility for a small fee.
How do they get in touch with you? Website?
The best way is by phone. Our phone number is 435-200-5730. And we also have a Facebook account, facebook.com/Park City Compost. And the website is still in the process of being built, but it'll be www.parkcitycompost.com.
Okay.
And our phone number is for our tree service. So if it says low stump tree service, that's us.
Don't be surprised.
That was our original
Right.
That's where we started.
That's where the wood chips come from, for the most part.
Yep. So how are you balancing those two businesses? That's a lot on your hands.
It's a juggling act every day.
Colin's the compost guy. I'm the tree guy, and we just get it done. So
there you go.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
So you're going to have a name for this finished product, you know, the packages?
Yeah.
That can't just be Park City Compost. Well, it could be. I mean, it's like Milwaukee is Milorganite. Right? Milwaukee's wastewater treatment plant has compost their sludge, and they're now famous for their Milorganite. So you guys got to come up with a catchy.
Yeah, definitely.
You'll have to help us with that.
Yeah, if you think of something, let us know.
There's a challenge.
We'll take input on our Facebook page.
There you go. Name the compost.
Name the compost contest. So, well, Colin Beach and Travis Wright of Park City Compost LLC, thanks so much for joining us. We really admire you guys.
Thanks for having us.
This was just something you guys saw an opportunity, didn't like what you saw what was going on with this waste stream, and decided to make a change. Perfect. And so far, so good.
So far, so good.
Next time you come in, you got to bring in some of the finished product.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So, and actually, you know, not to add to your burdens, but that would be great if you can get somehow visit some schools around here and show the kids how you go from salad, you know, greens waste to this finished product and how that process works. It's really fascinating.
Definitely. Yeah.
So thanks again for joining us. And the number again is 435-200-5730 if you want to contact Colin and Travis about trees and or compost. So thanks once again for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Let's take a break for some underwriters. And when we come back, we'll have our next guest, a couple professors from Utah State University, talking about fire ecology and how ecosystems recover following forest fires. It's a really fascinating topic. It's This Green Earth, and we'll be back after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
This is Ann from Park City Nursery and the Park City Tree Ranch. We're proud to have helped KPCW grow and flourish since 1983. Park City Nursery and the Tree Ranch have a variety of products to help your yard and garden do the same. Flowers, seeds, shrubs, and trees, water-wise sprinklers, consulting, and landscaping. We know what grows at parkcitynursery.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at prud-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. She's Nell Larson. While we wait for our next guest to call in, we did want to talk a little bit more about
our last
Park
guest,
City Compost. Yeah.
So we were, you know, Chris and I were curious to see the site, and we asked about, you know, getting a tour, and they said they've actually had a lot of interest in getting tours of this site. And they're happy to show around groups. So if you, you know, have a group that you'd be
Want to learn more about how large-scale composting systems work.
This gets a little more complicated than your backyard compost.
It is. Magnitude can be magnitudes more complicated and energy intensive, like I say, water intensive sometimes. You got to have the right key. It's like you were
like
saying.
Like they said, you got to take the temp. You got to keep make sure the airflow is, you know, accurate. You have to watch the water levels.
You got to keep the bacteria happy because that's what's going on. Right. Bacteria in there breaking down these all this organic material into another type of organic material. So
and the benefit of, you know, keeping the oxygen going through the compost, as we've discussed before, is that you get that aerobic breakdown instead of anaerobic breakdown. And that is where you're going to get, you know, you're going to avoid the methane creation of putting that food in the dump.
That's, you know what, now that's what makes us different from, but that's what makes us different from every other environmental show out there.
What?
We talk anaerobic bacteria.
That's right. On a regular basis.
Methane generators.
Can't get enough.
You really want to learn details, drill down into the details of environmental systems. That's why you listen to this Green Earth. And while we're at it, again, thanks for last week for a pledge drive to all of you who pledged. This Green Earth did a great job.
Yeah, thanks to you, don't want to brag.
Well, we were the winning public affairs. It was really some at Sotheby's that did all the heavy lifting. We had like some 70 calls last week of pledges, and we really thank those who called in, and some at Sotheby's who was on the show with myself.
And a huge amount of support from all the employees and the, you know, realtors and everyone that called in.
Okay. So still waiting for our guest to call in, but we'll talk a little bit about what happened. This is about, 3 weeks ago or so now, there was the Rockport 5 mm-hmm. fire out in Wanship Township. About 2,500 acres were burned. I'm sure, Nell, you were paying very close attention to it.
I had a great view of the planes coming in with the water and the fire retardant, and it was, you know, incredibly smoky.
Did it threaten Swanner at any point? Did you guys get
nervous? We didn't feel like the Swanner Preserve was under an immediate threat because there were several, you know, a couple miles of area with homes and neighborhoods in between the fire and Swanner. And so in order to get that far, it would have had to take a serious turn for the worse.
Right. It would have had to drop. It was the prevailing winds were taking it away. But some 2,500 acres or so did burn over a 3 or 4 day period. Most of it sage and scrub and grassland,
Gamble oak, scrub oak,
okay. And of course there were some structures affected too, and that's what really draws people's attention. But we're kind of curious more about what happens to ecosystems during a fire. How do plants and bugs and birds and animals escape a fire? Do they have time to? How do they do it? Do they survive? But then what happens after the fire? How do ecosystems recover?
How long does that take? How quickly do these things come back?
Right. So we found ourselves some specialists who can help explain how these ecosystems recover. We hopefully have one or at least both of them on the line. Michael Coons and Eric Thacker are, among other things, forestry specialists and professors at Utah State University, and they join us now on the line. Let's see who's there. Is it Michael and Eric?
This is Mike.
Hi, Mike.
And I'm a forestry specialist, and then Eric is a range specialist. And Eric, are you here? he was going to be calling in any minute.
Yeah, we'll get him in
on a
separate line.
Keep an eye out.
Let's start here, Michael. The fire itself, when a fire occurs, and this one in Rockport 5 fire out at Rockport Reservoir was started by a lightning strike, and it took off quickly, middle of the afternoon. Just, you know, worst case scenario, right? Winds were already high and stuff, and this spread. How are animals and insects and even plants able to survive a fire or get away from a fire like this?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there would be exceptions, but if a fire is moving slow enough, then animals that can obviously move will get out of the way, or some may have burrows that they can go down into. For the most part, yes, they can. Sometimes you hear about wild animals and livestock also being overtaken by a fire, but that would be less common.
Yeah, I've actually read something to the effect that some animals won't necessarily flee. They'll just kind of hang around on the edges of the fire because they kind of, I don't know if they have this innate sense that they're either safe or it's not an issue, but that classic Disney image of everything just fleeing, running for their lives is not necessarily the case.
Right, that's right.
Okay.
Larger animals, I think it'd be more likely they're going to have to get away from the fire to survive.
Okay.
So then in the wake of a fire like this, what are the first things to start moving back into this burned area?
Well, just in general, you have what in plant ecology are called pioneer species. And typically that would be annual plants that can seed in, and their life cycle is often geared toward, at least out here, is often geared towards coming into bare ground. Now, some pioneer species are geared towards coming in after a flood, but others are geared to come in after a fire, and really they're both disturbances, just different kinds of disturbances. So pioneers would be annuals, and then later on, as those annuals occupy the site and maybe make it a little better place for something else to grow, then perennials might come in. But of course, we have some annuals in Utah in particular. Cheatgrass that can affect a site in such a way that you may only get cheatgrass for a long time, because cheatgrass promotes fire, and so you can get a fire coming back in regularly and suppressing the growth of perennials.
And cheatgrass is an invasive species, right? So that, you know, is it, you know, blocking out other species from coming back?
I don't know all the ways cheatgrass might do that, but I do know that, and here we have a forester talking about a grass, so take this with a grain of salt, but I do know that cheatgrass dries out and is very flammable during the fire season, and so it's common for cheatgrass to burn and burn again and burn again. And when that happens, then if something like, say, a juniper seedling starts to take hold, and then two or three years later another fire comes through, the juniper burns up, and the juniper isn't very good, when it's young at least, at sprouting after a fire from its roots, so you end up with just cheatgrass or cheatgrass and a few other plants.
Okay. I think hopefully joining us on the other line is Eric Thacker. He's also a range extension specialist and professor at Utah State University. Eric, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, thanks. Feel free to join in with whatever, if you heard what we were just talking about with respect to cheatgrass, and I guess those are considered invasives or opportunists in that sense.
Yeah, and one of the things that they do that really messes with things is once they've established and then a disturbance has created a favorable environment where they become the dominant species in the landscape, they actually change soil properties and the way water cycles within the soil to where it makes it very difficult for other plants to establish. And so they kind of have a knockout punch once they've established, and especially after that first disturbance once they've established, because then they create a situation that's very difficult for perennial, native perennial vegetation to reestablish in those disturbed sites.
So at this, you know, in this Rockport fire site where, you know, it was kind of this sagebrush, grassland, Gambles Oak kind of environment, what are some of the other native annuals or pioneer species that we might see coming in? You know, what might we expect to see this coming spring in that area?
Well, the thing about that Gamble Oak community is the Gamble Oak is a resprouter, so it'll be back next spring. And all of the native grasses, the perennial native grasses, if they were in good condition and if there's not a lot of cheatgrass in those systems, then the native grasses, most of your native vegetation will all recover quite well. These systems, the Gamble Oak and those higher elevations sagebrush systems, are relatively well adapted to fire. Now, if fire becomes too frequent in the case of cheatgrass changing that fire regime from, say, a fire every 20, 30, 40, 50 years to every 3 to 5 years, then those native perennials can no longer persist in those systems, and that's when cheatgrass really becomes the dominant vegetation. So in the spring, I would expect to see much of what was there come back. Now, sagebrush will be the slowest returner to that community. It'll take a while, maybe up to 10 years, before you start to see much sagebrush coming back into that system. But most of the native vegetation will recover on its own.
And is that dependent upon the fact that their roots are still relatively intact and weren't damaged? Or is that from seed, the seed bank in the soil?
No, most of the perennial vegetation, well, if it's perennial vegetation, they will come back from the rootstock in terms of grass and the Gamble Oak. The sagebrush is not a resprouter, so once you kill the top of the sagebrush, it dies. Mm. So it's got to come back from seed. So there are some plants that will come back from seed, but a lot of species in those more fire-prone systems like that will come back from the rootstock that's in the soil. Again, sagebrush would be probably the most notable that will not and will have to come back from seed.
Okay, well, let's then talk a little bit about plant, animals or insects or birds. How do they repopulate an area? Let's say it's not a cheatgrass. That cheatgrass doesn't move in, that, you know, beneficial normal
native
species come back. How do the animals and insects repopulate those areas? What kind of rate do they repopulate?
So that can be highly variable depending on what type of habitat those species require. So we'll say larger mammals like deer and elk, I would expect to see those on that freshly burnt patch in the spring. Hmm. They'll come back pretty quick because the grass and the regrowth that's coming is highly nutritious and very advantageous for them, and so they'll be there because the feed's good. But if you're talking about species that require, say, the shrubby structure, so some songbirds or even sagegrass require sagebrush, they'll be slower to return to those areas because they need some of that habitat structure, and they need some of those shrubs to be back, you know, in a certain height and certain densities to where they feel comfortable. But some of the species will be back, you know, as soon as the vegetation greens back up. So it's highly variable. Hmm. You know, some it may take, you know, say, for example, if sage grouse were using that area, you know, it might take 10 years. It may be shorter than that depending on the size of the fire. So it's really quite variable as to how quick species will respond or return from after a fire like that.
So I like that you mentioned, you know, this is actually in some ways could be a benefit for some of the larger animals who come back for this really high quality feed that shows up in the scar of a fire. Can you talk a little bit about maybe some of the benefits of fire in a natural ecosystem and what kind of role like fire and disturbance might play?
Well, I think that's a really important point to bring up because this system we're talking about that Rockport fire burnt through is what I would consider a fire-prone system, not only because fires occur there, but fires are a part of that system. So as you get to the higher elevations of that fire, there's some aspen, and aspen requires fire to cause resprouting and might being the forester, could probably talk better about that. But fire being part of this system, it's a natural process. And so a lot of these species have adapted and evolved to take advantage of those opportunities, for example, the increase in green forage. And you do get different proportions of the landscape being made up of. So following a fire, grasses, for example, and some of the forbs or the flowering plants are able to respond much quicker than some of the woody vegetation. So you'll actually get more grass and more forbs or flowering plants following a fire. And so for like deer and elk during the summertime and spring, when they're eating a lot of grass, that's very important for them because then they have high-quality grass and forbs to consume during that time. So the other thing fire does that's important is it helps to restructure and cause, we like to call it heterogeneity or just differences across the landscape. If all of the landscape looks exactly the same, meaning the shrubs are at the same density or the same amounts and the same levels in the grass, then it limits how many species are able to use that landscape. And as you cause a lot of diversity and differences in age structure of vegetation across the landscape, it actually avails itself to a higher proportion of wildlife to use that landscape. So fire is really important, I guess, the bottom line in some of these landscapes at the right proportion.
Right. Well, if you just joined us, we're speaking with Professors Michael Koons and Eric Thacker. They're out of Utah State University. They're also a specialist in forestry and rangeland extensions. And we're talking about how ecosystems recover from fire and using the Rockport 5 fire as an example of what we hope now is a proper recovery and not an invasive species type of recovery. Because like you say, if cheatgrass gets in there, not only does it have a physical impact, it has a chemical impact to the soil.
Well, and what, this is Mike, I'm glad Eric showed up because he knows more about some of these things than I do. One thing that land management agencies will do if fire has gone through a system that where cheatgrass maybe is a likely species to replace some of what was there, they'll actually get seed mixes together and go out and seed. I think sometimes even in the fall after a fire, they try to get on species that are going to be able to compete and hold their own against species like cheatgrass so that it's less likely. They get the site occupied by plant material that they want, and it's less likely that something they don't want is going to take over. And sometimes those are native species. Sometimes it's a mix of native and non-native. But presumably non-natives that would be less likely to take over the way cheatgrass does.
Right. And
then when it comes to forests, if it's burning in Gambalope, unless it would be an extremely hot fire with lots of fuel that might actually kill the oak root system, most likely the oak will start to come back the following year. And, you kill the tops, but you haven't killed the oak trees. They're there underground, and they'll come back. Mm. And then aspen is similar. It's actually harder to burn aspen with a fire, but if it burns, then, again, it'll come back from its root system. It's clonal. So you end up with genetically identical aspen stands to what you had before.
Right. Well, we got a few more minutes, and I actually want to make sure we touch on the Yosemite fire. But what can homeowners do who live out in the Rockport area, Wanchep Township, whose homes weren't burned, but yet their surrounding areas were consumed? What can a homeowner do to kind of help this recovery? What can they plant, or what could they? How could they cultivate their area?
Well, in my opinion, what they need to think of near their, if they have a home in the area, near their home, they don't really want to recover a native landscape. So I'm talking within 30 feet, certainly, and out to about 100 feet from their structures. They need to plan for a landscape that does not resemble the native landscape that burned up around them, because, you know, if they go for that, then they're going for a lot of hazard to their home and them for the future. They need to bring down the native landscape, native plant material like the oak, kind of step down to lower stature, lower fuel buildup, moister plants in the fire season. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, when you look at pictures of homes that do the best at, when a fire comes through, they're not the home nestled into the woods the way people tend to like to have it. They tend to be more, I hate to say barren, but less vegetation near the home, things like concrete driveways and patios and, I looked at a home that had survived the fire by a Harriman last summer, and several homes around it had burned. This one hadn't, and yet they had firebrands that had landed around the home, and I could see where a little piece of a branch had burned out where it landed. And what saved that home was having a horse pasture in back that was pretty well eaten down, so very little fuel, mm-hmm. and then a gravel pad for RV near the home, and then a driveway in one place, sidewalks, and it was lack of fuel that saved the home. So
right.
You have to have fairly little fuel to be safe in those environments.
And we heard a similar story, actually, from this Rockport fire. There was a home that, you know, was completely surrounded by fire, but thanks to the defensible space, the home itself, you know, didn't burn. It was able to be saved.
Sure.
But, you know, you mentioned another fire, and I'm curious, are there other fires that have taken place in this area that, you know, are maybe similar in size or scope or type to this Rockport fire that would be an example of what we might expect to see in future years?
I'm sure there have been. And Eric just moved back here from being in Oklahoma for a few years.
Okay.
I mean, the fires, there's been several fires in the Harriman area that have burned off of the Gamble Oak, mostly on Camp Williams, the National Guard facility. And then have burned down into those neighborhoods at the south end of the Salt Lake Valley. And there's lots of homes and lots of gamble oak in and amongst the homes. It'd be oak and maple mainly, and then whatever vegetation people have planted when they establish their landscapes.
Okay. So we've got a couple of minutes left, and we'd like to recommend some resources to our listeners. Are there, you know, websites, places they can go online to find out more about, you know, either the steps to take after a fire or information about fire ecology?
Yeah. So one of the first, if there's fires happening and they want to know about where the fires are, how big they are, things like that, of course, they can look at in the news, but they can also look at utahfireinfo.gov. That's just all one word, Utah Fire Info. And then I recommend they also look at
On our Extension Forestry website, there's a FireWise landscaping section. So I'm pretty sure if they would do a web search and just search for FireWise Landscaping Utah, one thing they'll find is a booklet that we have available, and they can either order it or they can just look at it online. And it's called FireWise Landscaping for Utah, and it talks about how to zone your landscape to bring the amount of fuel down as you approach the home and make it safer. But there's some other resources there as well related to fire and prescribed fire. And then there's a firewise.org website, which is a national website, and it's got a lot of good information about landscaping, things like that. And then finally, on extension.org, so just the word extension.org, there's an wildfire information network you can look for once you go to extension.org, and it's got lots of articles about before, during, and after a fire, what to do, what not to do, and how to recover after a fire. It's even got things like articles on how to deal with your, say if you have horses or something or other livestock and a fire's coming.
Okay.
What to do.
All right, well, we have to run. Again, thanks, Michael Coons and Eric Thacker, both professors at Utah State University and specialists in forestry and rangeland, talking about fires and ecosystems. Thanks again for joining us on This Green Earth.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, let's take another quick break. When we come back, we'll try to get in this one last story and wrap up. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Dr. Hart and Dr. Adams, a Park City specialty group, are board-certified surgeons who help locally with minimally invasive procedures to screen, diagnose, and treat hernias. An experienced and comfortable surgery option closer to your loved ones and friends is available locally for you. Visit them online at parkcityspecialty.com or call today at 435-658-7400. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Join us for The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Head into summer with us as we explore health, nutrition, and lifestyle with the experts.
From going gluten-free to finding your balance.
From bike position to relationship alignment.
From the educational journey to navigating wellness.
That's Wednesdays at 9 a.m. on The Mountain Life, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you by Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Park City Clinic, and Grand Valley Bank.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. It's we got a minute or so to wrap up. We don't have time to get to my story about oil shale and this proposed process of retorting oil shale. You won't believe what this is about. You can look for the letter that I submitted to Salt Lake Tribune. It should be coming out in today's paper or tomorrow's paper discussing that issue. But in the meantime, we'll talk about that next week. We've got
That's
a minute.
Right.
Nell, you're away for the next 3 weeks.
That's
Why?
Right. I'm missing three shows. I'm heading to Bhutan to visit the country and travel around a little bit.
Bhutan, Texas?
It's between China and India, near Nepal, the other side of the globe. So I'll come back with lots of stories and information
and we'll
about all the cool environmental things they're doing over there.
I'll have a good, we'll get a good 10-minute discussion.
Yeah, I'll be a guest.
Exactly. And in the meantime, I'll have some co-hosts. We'll be interviewing some authors. I have an interesting interview I did with the CEO of Rocky Mountain Power. And that is going to be coming up next week. You'll want to be tuned in for that. Real interesting conversation with what's going on there with Rocky Mountain Power and renewables. It's This Green Earth. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you in 3 weeks, 4 weeks now.
That's right.
All right. Here's NPR.